Welcome back, everyone, for another deep dive. You know, we love to get into the nitty-gritty here, and today we are taking on a topic that's pretty fundamental to, well, to just about everything, really. I mean, it's money, right? How it works, how it flows in an economy.
Yeah, the lifeblood of the system.
Exactly. And to make it a little more manageable, we're going to zero in on, yeah, the household, you know, you're listening to this, your financial decisions, it's all connected. And we've got some really interesting research here that dives into the whole relationship between you and me and all the other households out there and businesses, the firms that we interact with every day, and all the factors, you know, all the things that influence the money we earn and then how we decide to spend it or not spend it.
Right. All those choices we make add up.
So over the next, 20 minutes, half hour, something like that, we're going to map out this whole circular flow of income thing. Break it down, you know, what are the types of income you might receive and what are the big choices you face spending, saving, oh, and borrowing, of course, can't forget about that. And then there's this whole ripple effect thing called the multiplier. It's actually pretty fascinating.
Yeah, the multiplier is a key concept.
Yeah.
It really shows you how interconnected everything is.
So that's our mission today, to give you a clear, insightful, I would say entertaining look at these core economic principles, you know, the stuff that's actually playing out in your life right now as we speak.
It's about equipping you with the knowledge to understand the forces that shape your financial reality.
Okay, so let's jump right into it. This whole engine of the economy, you were talking about the circular flow of income. The research lays out this two-sector model to keep things simple, you know, just households and firms. So can you kind of sketch out how this whole money-go-round works?
Sure. So imagine, like, this household, you and me, we're the providers. We supply all the essential ingredients that businesses need to, you know, to operate, to produce the stuff we all want.
Raw materials, you mean?
Well, yeah, raw materials. Mm. But it's broader than that. Think land, you know, the actual physical space where a factory gets built or a store sets up shop. Then there's labor, the people doing the work, and capital, which might be money that you've saved that a business borrows to expand. And then there's this thing called enterprise, which is like the spark, the innovation, the organization. All that comes from someone taking a risk starting a business. We lump all of these together and call them the factors of production, and households are the ones supplying them to the firms.
Okay, so we provide the resources, labor, the investment that businesses need to get going.
Exactly. And in return for providing all those crucial ingredients, firms pay income back to us, to the households. So if you own some land that a company is using, you're going to receive rent, right? If you work for a company, you earn wages. If you've invested in the company, maybe you buy some stock or you lend them some money, you might receive interest or return on your investment. And then if you're the one starting the business, organizing everything, taking all the risks, that's where profit comes in. That's the reward for, you know, for the entrepreneurship.
Got it. So the resources flow one way from households to firms, and then the income flows back the other way. That's the first half of the circle. So what happens next? How does that income complete the loop?
Well, that income, the money that households receive, those wages, rent, interest, profits, yeah, all of that, that becomes what we use to purchase the goods and services that firms produce.
Mm-hmm.
So you get your paycheck, you go to the grocery store, you pay your rent or your mortgage. You might buy a new phone, a new pair of shoes, all the things we buy.
Or maybe a vacation, exactly, yeah. Vacation too, that spending. That's what creates demand. It's what keeps those businesses going. It mm-hmm. gives them the incentive to keep producing more stuff and, you know, to keep needing those factors of production from households in the first place. So it's really this continuous cycle, right? Resources flow to firms, yeah. Income flows back to households. Households spend that income on goods and services produced by firms, and round and round it goes.
It's like this beautifully balanced ecosystem in a way that businesses need us for our resources and our labor, and we need them for all the stuff they make.
We're interdependent.
Absolutely. Yep. And money is what makes this whole exchange possible. So you mentioned all those different types of income, rent, wages, interest and profit. Let's unpack those a bit. I mean, wages are pretty straightforward, right? Most people understand that. But what about those other types of income?
Sure. Well, rent, as we said, that's the payment for the use of land or property. Could be an apartment, could be a farm, could be a whole office building.
Right. Wages, that's what you get for your labor, your work, your skills, your time, and then interest, or rate of return as it's sometimes called, that's the money you earn when you let someone else use your capital.
So like putting your money in a savings account.
Yeah, exactly. A savings account, or you buy a bond, mm-hmm. or you invest in a company that's you lending your money out, and you earn interest on that loan. Basically, it's like the reward for delaying your own spending and letting someone else use your money to do something productive. And then finally, profit. That's what the entrepreneur, the risk taker, the person who brings all the other factors of production together, that's what they earn after all the costs are covered. You know, the cost of rent and wages and materials and everything else. Profit is the reward for successful business ventures for innovation.
Right, the incentive to create something new or to do something better.
Exactly. And it's important to remember that these are earnings for households, but they're also costs for the firms, right? So it's all connected.
Okay, that makes sense. So all these different income streams, they add up to a household's total income, right? But then in the research, I see this term disposable income. What's the difference between our total income and our disposable income?
Yeah, good question. Disposable income, that's essentially your take-home pay. It's what's left after the government takes its cut, right? So we're talking taxes. And then it also includes any benefits or transfer payments you might receive, like unemployment benefits or Social Security. So it's your total income minus taxes, plus any government benefits. That's the money you actually have at your disposal to spend or save.
Right. The money that hits your bank account ready to be used.
Exactly.
Okay. So this disposable income, that's what really drives how much we spend, right? I mean, it's pretty intuitive. The more money you have, the more you can spend. But the notes point out that it's not the only thing that influences our spending decisions. What else is going on there?
Yeah, that's a great point. Disposable income is definitely key, but your wealth also matters a lot. Wealth is the total value of everything you own. Your savings, your investments, your house, your car, if you've got valuable artwork, that counts too.
So it's not just about how much you earn each month, it's about the total value of your assets.
Precisely. Someone with a lot of wealth, they might feel more comfortable spending a bigger chunk of their disposable income, maybe even dipping into savings, compared to someone with very little wealth, even if their current incomes are similar.
So if you've got that comfortable nest egg built up, you might be more likely to say, go on that big vacation or buy that fancy new gadget, even if your monthly paycheck isn't all that different from someone who doesn't have those savings.
Exactly. And then there's a third factor to consider, the rate of interest, you know, how much it costs to borrow money.
Right, because higher interest rates mean it's more expensive to take out a loan.
Exactly. So you might think twice about buying that new car or that new house if interest rates are really high. On the other hand, high interest rates can make saving more attractive because you earn a better return when you put your money in the bank.
Interesting. So interest rates can actually push us in two different directions. They can make us less likely to borrow and more likely to save.
Exactly. It's all about incentives.
Okay, so let's focus on the spending itself. The notes define consumption as using goods and services for our current needs and wants, you know, like buying groceries or getting a haircut. And they specifically distinguish that from investment. Why is that distinction so important?
It all comes down to the purpose and the time frame consumption. That's about satisfying immediate needs and wants. I'm hungry, I need to eat, I need a new pair of shoes because mine have holes in them. It's about using things up right here, right now. Investment, on the other hand, that's about acquiring assets that you expect will generate income or benefits in the future.
So like a business buying a new machine to boost production.
Exactly. Yeah. Or if you buy a stock or a bond, you're hoping it will grow in value over time. That's an investment. You're not consuming it. You're holding on to it, expecting it to generate a return. And this distinction matters because consumption drives immediate economic activity, while investment lays the groundwork for future growth.
Okay, so buying that new phone, that's consumption. A company building a new factory, that's investment. One satisfies a present, while the other aims to increase future productivity.
Right.
The research also talks about this concept of the average propensity to consume, or APC. Can you explain that one?
Sure. The APC, it's basically the percentage of your total income that you actually spend. So if you earn, let's say, $100 and you spend $75, your APC is 0.75 or 75%.
Okay. Simple enough. So what does a higher or lower APC tell us about a household?
Well, a higher APC suggests that a household is spending a larger chunk of their income. Could mean they're saving less, or maybe they just have more immediate needs they need to fulfill.
Like putting food on the table?
Exactly. Lower income households often have a higher APC because a bigger part of their income has to go towards essential goods and services. On the other hand, a lower APC, that indicates that a household is saving more of their income.
Which makes sense, because if you're earning more, you probably have more left over after you cover your basic needs.
Higher income households, they tend to have more discretionary income. Yeah. You know, the money that's left over after the necessities are taken care of, and they can choose to save a bigger portion of that if they want to. And these shifts in the overall APC, they can actually give economists some clues about consumer confidence. You know, how optimistic or pessimistic people are feeling about the economy.
Yeah, that makes sense. If people are feeling good about the future, they might be more willing to spend a larger portion of their income.
Exactly.
Which brings us nicely to saving. It's the flip side of spending, right? It's the portion of our income that we don't spend right away. We set it aside. And just like there's an APC, there's an average propensity to save, or APS, which is simply the percentage of income that goes into savings.
All right. Your APC and APS will always add up to 1 or 100% because every dollar of your income is either spent or saved. There's no other option.
Makes sense. So why is saving so important? I mean, obviously, it's good to have some money tucked away for a rainy day, but what's the bigger economic significance?
Well, for individuals, saving is crucial. It provides a safety net. You know, if you lose your job or you have a medical emergency, you've got something to fall back on. It also allows you to invest in your future.
Yeah.
You know, save for a down payment on a house, save for retirement, save for your kids' education. All that good stuff. And then from a broader economic perspective, saving is what makes investment possible. Those savings that households accumulate, they can be channeled through banks and financial markets into businesses that need capital to grow and expand.
Yeah.
So saving is actually a key driver of economic growth.
Right. So it's not just about being personally responsible. It's actually contributing to the overall health of the economy.
Absolutely.
So what are some of the big factors that influence how much a household decides to save?
Well, there are quite a few things that come into play. Income level is a major one. Mm-hmm. Obviously, higher income households tend to have more capacity to save simply because they have more money left over after covering their basic expenses. Then there's interest rates we talked about, that higher interest rates can make saving more attractive because you earn a better return. And then expectations about the future are also really important. If you're feeling optimistic about your job security and you expect your income to keep growing, you might be less inclined to save as much.
You might feel like you can afford to spend more now.
It's exactly. On the other hand, if you're worried about the economy or you're not sure about your job security, you might save more just to be on the safe side. And then there's inflation. If prices are rising quickly, the value of your savings can erode.
Yeah.
So that might make people less inclined to save because they're worried that their money won't be worth as much in the future. And then finally, there are your personal financial goals. You know, are you saving for a down payment on a house? Are you saving for retirement? Are you saving for your kids' college education? Those goals, they have a big influence on how much you choose to save.
It's a lot to juggle, you know, our current needs and wants, and then our hopes and fears for the future, and all of that gets filtered through our income and, you know, whatever's going on in the economy at the moment.
It's a dynamic process for sure.
So the research then goes on to look at spending patterns across different income levels. And some of the observations are pretty intuitive. You know, wealthier households tend to spend more overall, but they also tend to spend their money differently than lower income households.
Yeah,
that's right. It's about priorities. Lower income households, they have to devote a larger portion of their income to just covering the basics.
Yeah.
Food, clothing, shelter, transportation, healthcare, you know, the things you need to survive.
The essentials.
Exactly. Whereas wealthier households, once those basic needs are met, they have more money left over to spend on other things. They might buy more luxury goods, you know, expensive cars, designer clothes,
yeah,
fancy vacations. They might buy more durable goods, things that are built to last, you know, high-end appliances, furniture, that sort of thing. And they tend to spend more on services, things like travel, entertainment, personal care.
So as income rises, spending on necessities goes down as a percentage of total spending, and spending on these other categories goes up.
That's the general trend, and it's interesting, this pattern isn't just something you see within a single country. It also holds true when you compare spending patterns across different countries. Mm-hmm. You know, poorer countries tend to spend a much bigger chunk of their national income on necessities compared to wealthier countries.
It's a reminder that your economic circumstances, they really shape your priorities, what you spend your money on.
Absolutely.
Okay, so let's shift gears a bit and talk about borrowing, which is essentially spending future income in the present. Why do people do this? Why do we take on debt?
Well, there are a lot of reasons borrowing can be a really useful tool. For example, it allows for consumption smoothing. So let's say you experience a temporary drop in income. You know, you lose your job or your hours get cut back. Borrowing can help you maintain your standard of living during that rough patch. You don't have to suddenly slash your spending. You can borrow to bridge the gap.
So it helps you smooth out the bumps in the road.
Exactly. And borrowing also makes it possible to finance big purchases like a house or a car. Mm-hmm. And most people can't just pay for those things outright. They need a loan to make it happen.
Right. A mortgage for a house or a car loan.
Exactly. And borrowing can also be used to invest in education.
Yeah.
You know, student loans are a huge part of how people pay for college or to cover unexpected medical expenses. You know, if you have a sudden illness or injury, and you don't have the savings to cover it, you might need to borrow to pay those medical bills. And then sometimes people borrow in anticipation of their income rising in the future. Now, they might take out a loan to buy a house or a car, knowing that they'll be able to afford the repayments more easily once they get that promotion or that raise.
So it's about using future earnings to improve your present circumstances.
Precisely.
The notes specifically mention mortgages as a prime example of long-term borrowing, often the biggest financial commitment most people ever make. What are some of the main things that influence whether a household decides to take on debt?
Well, interest rates are a big factor, as we've already talked about. When interest rates are low, borrowing becomes less expensive and therefore more appealing. So you might be more likely to take out a loan for a house or a car when rates are low.
It's like a sale on money.
Yeah, in a way. And then there's the availability of credit. You know, are banks and other lenders willing to give you a loan? And what kind of terms are they offering? Credit is easy to get and the terms are favorable. People are more likely to borrow. But if lenders are being really strict and interest rates are high, that can discourage borrowing. And then finally, there's confidence in future income. Mm. If you feel secure about your job and you expect your income to rise, you might be more comfortable taking on debt because you feel confident that you'll be able to repay it.
So it's all about balancing the cost of borrowing with the potential benefits.
Exactly.
Okay, we've covered a lot of ground here. We've traced the flow of income, how we use it for spending and saving, why we might borrow against future earnings now. Let's tackle this concept of the multiplier effect. It sounds a bit like a chain reaction. You know, one person spending some money leads to another person earning some money, and then they spend it, and so on and so on.
Yeah, it's like a ripple effect that spreads through the economy. So imagine this. Your household decides to spend an extra $100. Let's say you buy a new bookshelf. That $100 goes to the furniture store as revenue. The store owner then uses some of that money to pay their employees or to order more bookshelves from the manufacturer. Those employees, they now have more income and they might go out and spend that money at a restaurant or they might buy some clothes. And then the manufacturer, they see increased demand, so they might hire more workers or invest in new equipment to boost production and so on and so on. That initial $100 doesn't just disappear, it keeps circulating through the economy, creating income and spending at each step.
So that initial spending, it multiplies, it leads to a bigger overall increase in economic activity.
Exactly. That's the multiplier effect. And the size of that multiplier, it's influenced by something called the marginal propensity to consume, or MPC. The MPC is the proportion of an additional dollar of income that a household chooses to spend rather than save.
Okay, so if I get an extra $100 and I spend 80 of it, my MPC is 0.8.
Exactly. And if the MPC is high, meaning people tend to spend most of any extra income they receive, then the multiplier effect will be larger because each round of spending will be bigger. But if the MPC is low, if people tend to save most of that extra income, then the multiplier effect will be smaller.
So if everyone suddenly got really frugal and started saving every extra penny, the economy wouldn't get much of a boost.
Precisely. The impact of that initial spending would be much more limited. But if people are inclined to spend that extra income, you get a much bigger ripple effect.
So it really highlights how interconnected everything is. You know, my spending becomes someone else's income, their spending becomes someone else's income, and so on.
It's all part of this continuous circular flow.
This has been a really fascinating look at the core mechanics of a simplified economy. You know, we've seen how money flows between households and firms. We've broken down all the different types of income. We've explored the factors that influence how we spend and save and borrow. And we've even uncovered this powerful multiplier effect.
And by understanding these core principles, you, the listener, you're now better equipped to understand your own financial decisions and the larger economic forces at play in the world around you.
Exactly. So here's a final thought for you to consider. How might even small changes in your own financial behavior, you know, maybe you decide to increase your savings rate, or maybe you make a big purchase, or maybe you get a raise, or unfortunately a pay cut. How might those changes have consequences that extend beyond your own household? You're a vital part of this circular flow, and your choices, they matter. They contribute to the bigger picture. So thanks for taking this deep dive with us.
It's been a pleasure.
And we'll see you next time for another deep dive into the fascinating world of economics.